I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move
it. I feel like that should be a rule in all movies, is like, just don't trust the guy named Cyrus.
Yeah,
he's never up to any good. It's just, if your name is Cyrus, you're no. Cyrus the Virus, you're Cyrus Joey Pants from the Matrix. As soon as someone's like, I'd like to help you with your bank robbery, I'm Cyrus, I'd be like, all right, well, I'm Dan, and you're fired because your name is Cyrus. Yeah. And it's just not gonna happen.
Or Joel.
What's your deal with Joel?
I just don't trust people named Joel.
Not even Joel Schumacher, but then he's got a mixed bag, although I do love the guy. What about Joel?
Yeah.
Joel
McHale.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, if you're making a broad sitcom about a niche occupation where you need a group of comedians to just kind of improv for the camera, look no further than Joel McHale. That's his whole thing.
Joel Kinnaman.
I like Joel Kinnaman.
Yeah, but he abandoned me for Altered Carbon season 2.
Fair enough. But what about like Joel from Mystery Science Theater? The original, the OG human.
No.
Just straight up no.
Too many robots.
That's a really insane position to take as the host of a movie podcast. But hey, that's where we are. So this is I'd Like to Movie. My name is Dan Scully.
I'm Steven Richards, and I hate robots.
He hates robots. You're talking about Altered Carbon and how you hate robots.
Well, okay, so I didn't hate robots this time last year, but now with the rise of AI.
Fair enough.
It's getting my hatreds. We're gonna have to start resisting.
Yeah, I mean, you got it. Well, there's two ways to go about it. You can resist, or you can bow down to your robot overlords. Get it out of the way.
If they promise to upload me into a robot myself, much like in that terrible Johnny Depp film that came out a few years ago.
Transcendence. They're going to be like, listen,
yes.
We're going to upload you into a robot internet.
Give me a transcendence there, Skynet.
Like, we're going to transcend you, and we've got this guy to help us out with it. I'd like you to meet our doctor, Dr. Joel Cyrus. Like,
no!
Why? See, I'm in
just
the
kidding. It's Dr. Mantis Toboggan.
Mantis Toboggan. I'm taking the AI thing down the middle. I'm playing both sides so that I always come out on top. So on the one hand, I don't use Siri. But on the other hand, when I do use Siri, I say thank you.
Okay, that's good.
That's where I'm at right now.
All those times I was like, Alexa, fuck you. And she said, well, that's not very nice. Now that's going to come back to haunt me.
That's going to come back to haunt you. I accidentally activated Siri the other day as I was saying, like, I was saying to Jenna that it was a nice day. And I went, oh, it's nice. And then Siri went, thank you. And I was like, all right. I think that knocked one of the times I told Siri to fuck herself. It knocked that one out. We're coming up even.
Right,
so
that's good.
Yeah, I think we're good. But before we get started, a little housekeeping up top. You can follow the show at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. You can check out our other show, our comedy podcast, Hot Property, at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. Leave us a review. Shoot us an email, moviemoviecast@gmail.com. Let us know what you want to cover.
Send a raven.
Send a raven. Send smoke signals, whatever it is that you can do to contact us. We want to listen. So, and thank you. We got a decent uptick in listeners over the last couple episodes. So thank you to all the new listeners. Welcome to the show. And we invite you to be part of I Like to Movie.
And if you're a new listener, send a raven.
Send a raven. Send a rave review by Raven. Raven by Ravens.
I like how in the movie podcast, we're just referencing television programs throughout.
Well, it's going to continue because I just started season 4 of Barry. And my goal is to catch up. And let me tell you, I'm going to catch up because it is crack. But I have the dumbest thing stuck in my head right now from a season 3 episode. No, I won't. there's a pretty heavy action scene in season three of Barry. And while it's happening, it starts and Barry's singing to himself. But as it progresses, he continues singing to himself. And the song that he's singing is something that Bill Hader just improvised on set. But it's been stuck in my head forever. And it goes like this. You're my buddy, you're my friend. You're my buddy, you're my friend. You're my buddy, you're my friend. And that's all it is. And he's singing that to him. Like the beginning of the scene, he's like, oh, my buddy, where'd you go? And then as just insane actions happening, he's just like, you're my buddy, you're my friend. You're my buddy.
Yeah.
It's fucking wild.
Juxtapose fight scenes like that, where like in Nobody, where they sing I've Gotta Be Me while he beats the shit of people on the bus. Like, I love, like, sign me up for one of those in every movie.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's like Pride and Prejudice, give me a fight scene to a weird song.
The that great super
might make that movie tolerable for me. The I hate period pieces.
You know, so Keira Knightley's a no-go for you across the board.
Well, except for Pirates of the Caribbean, but
fair enough.
I've already talked about that on Jenna's podcast.
Yes. I always wanted to do like an old period drama. And it would be like a period drama that looks like a Keira Knightley movie. It would star Keira Knightley, and the name of it would be Keira Knightley, because her name even feels like it. You know, she always plays like, you know, Emma Robinson in Emma Robinson, you know, whatever the name is. Yeah. It would just be like Keira Knightley in the role she was born to play. And then it shows her working the jaw, just being like, you left me, but I love you all the same. It's like Keira Knightley.
Well,
Keira Knightley.
We could do a Kaufman-esque situation. Here's our segue, by the way. We could do a Kaufman-esque situation where she is playing Keira Knightley, playing a role in a period piece that is being filmed.
We could do that. We could absolutely do that. So, yes, as the segue has brought us to today, we are going to be going deep on adaptation, the Charlie Kaufman penned, Spike Jonze directed film from, I believe, 2003. And the idea came up because this is a film about a writer, and currently the WGA is rightfully so on strike. And so in a small act of solidarity to shout out their cause, we are going to do a movie about writers.
And in solidarity, I did not write any notes for this podcast. And I watched the movie 3 days ago, so we'll see how it happens.
Well, I wrote a bunch of notes, but I typed them into my notes app. And since the TGA, the Typist Guild of America, is not on strike, I like to think that I'm not scabbing.
Well, that's good, because actually I did take notes, but I did write them on my typewriter. And it woke up the whole neighborhood. I got notes on my door. It was not a good time.
Movies he wrote. What's his name? I can't believe I just
Then I threw the page and it flew out the window, and then the stinger came up. This is movies he wrote.
Tom Hanks just donated a typewriter to the local typewriter shop on Passyunk, because apparently Tom Hanks is a passionate typewriter user.
What a Tom Hanks thing to do!
It's amazing.
Way.
It's so cool.
I saw that headline. I was like, that makes complete sense.
He's the man.
I'm not surprised by this at all.
He's everybody's dad. He's Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
You gotta love him. And he has nothing to do with adaptation. Although in adaptation, Charlie Kaufman does seem to be writing his script on a typewriter at some point. So he is a little bit of
That's how he exclusively writes it.
Yeah. So this, I don't know if that actually translates to real life Charlie Kaufman, but what we're dealing with in adaptation is a Charlie Kaufman version of his own real life. And everybody knows Charlie Kaufman as being a bit of a weirdo when it comes to the stuff that he writes. He writes the bizarre, but it's always pretty thematically resonant. It's always pretty deep. It's usually, you know, much more personal than you're apt to get in this kind of stuff. And I would say that adaptation, a story that is about his frustration trying to adapt an unadaptable book, really is one of his most personal works. So can you tell me, like, when was like the first time you saw adaptation, and when was the last time before this recent time that you saw it?
They're one and the same.
Really?
Yeah. I was working at a movie theater in New Paltz, New York, and it was in the theater. It was a four theater dealy. And so adaptation was really only in there for like 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they just couldn't spare the room. But it's also, it has like a big art house scene in that area. So like they had to pander a little bit to the old people and me, a promising young future film student that wanted to watch it. So I went down there by myself. I think maybe I had one other person with me. And it was, I was like, damn, this is something like I've never like I've seen before. And it was moving to me in a lot of ways. And then like a month later, when it came to the Rosendale Theater, which is a one auditorium theater that, but like only shows like exclusively like the stuff that you won't see next to a Blockbuster. It just shows art house pretty much exclusively. I was like, I got as many people as I could. I was like, you got to go watch this movie. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. Just come watch this movie with me. It's only $5. You can spare it. And we probably like 6 or 7 of us went to watch it. And let me tell you, the reviews were split almost down the middle. like the people who got it, like really got it and really, really enjoyed it. The people who didn't were like, what the fuck did I just watch? And I think like that is a lot of almost like the sub theme here where it's like, you don't want, as a writer, you don't want to have that last reaction unless it's intentional. You want that, you know, that resonation and that that feeling of connection with the audience. And during that initial phase, it's so hard to like see the future and see this coming to fruition from just the view in front of you as you write these words down. Mm-hmm. And like showing this process and showing all the second guessing and just showing like how easy it is for the cracks in the creative facade to show and start expanding. It, like that's something I definitely resonated with myself as a creative. And I love that aspect of it. And that kind of, because I love also one of the reasons I love, you know, the Conan O'Brien podcast, they peel the curtain back a lot on how comedy is created mm-hmm. and how like whoever's talking is like how they create what they create, and seeing this kind of almost satirical view, but like a very serious satire, if that's a thing. It's like, again, like I'm all over the place because the movie's all over the place with my review. Like,
I think you hit onto something though. The thing is that this is a satire, and it's a satire coming from within the entity that's being satirized. It's you know, this is Charlie Kaufman sort of making fun of his own plight, his own style, his own neuroses, and his own creative process. And it ends up,
and we're along for the ride, and it is a fucking ride.
It's a fucking ride, and it's super meta because he's struggling to write the movie that we are ultimately watching, and knowing the real story that he did, you know, not fail, but initially struggled with adapting what is essentially a nonfiction, you know, reading a documentary that you read, you know, that kind of a book. I guess nonfiction is the word, you know, and then turning it into a fictional
documentary
movie
that you read. I saw that sign in the bookstore.
Right on, yeah. Documentary that you read. I saw that at the paper movies store. And so, but the first time I saw this movie, I was already like over the moon for Spike Jonze because he was working with Jackass. He was he did so many Beastie Boys videos. I'm a big Beastie Boys fan, and he's one of those guys who was just like known as like the guy, you know. He was married to a Coppola for a short while, and so when you're like a young budding film nerd, he's already like,
is cool. That how he got Nick Cage for this?
I don't know. Potentially. It certainly is.
Probably not. That's just a joke.
But I was, what, 18, 19 when it came out? And so me and my friends went and we fancied ourselves the smart film guys in the room, even though we'd been alive for less than 2 decades. And so we're having a blast. We're having a hoot. And I remember, and to my great current shame, being young and immature, I remember me and my buddies were like, forcing more laughter almost as if to let the theater know that we're the cool guys, which is so shitty. And we laughed and I laughed loud in the scene that shows Chris Cooper's background, or LaRoche's background, how everybody died in the car crash. And that's not a comedic moment, but because I was young and dumb, it was a comedic moment to me. And the dude in the seat in front of me turned around and yelled at our whole group. He was like, can you? He's like, do you fucking mind? This is blah, blah. And it was like a total damper on the film experience. But my buddy Mike, who was with me, immediately was just like, what, you're gonna yell at us for laughing at a comedy? Turn around. And the dude, and it like put it to bed. And I was so ashamed because, like, in that moment I realized, no, we were the dickheads. But yeah. I was also like rocked because I was like, my boy had my back 100%, no questions asked. And yep. It kind of soured the whole movie experience for me. So I never really revisited it that much. And the second time I watched it, it was like maybe in my early 20s. And I loved the movie, but like it always brought up that yeah. element, that memory. And it just like felt weird in my gut. So then I watch it now. I'm 38 years old. I'm the same age that Nick Cage was while making the movie. I am a writer. I often feel anxious and trapped in myself in ways that are similar to Charlie, not as debilitating. But watching it with that history and from this angle just wrecked me. I was a mess rewatching this movie. It really hit home, especially because looking back, I thought, wow, I thought of myself as a Charlie back then, and I really wasn't. I guess I'm a little bit more of a Charlie now, sometimes to my own detriment, but watching this movie, I thought I would love to be much more of a Donald. I would love to be more earnest yeah. and hopeful. And my buddy Mike, who stood up for me no matter what in that theater situation, in that moment, he was the Donald. And
yeah,
you know, in an immature way where he was, he was not necessarily in the right yelling back at this guy, because like I said, we were dickheads, but it always stuck with me. And I don't know, that all just kind of came together watching this. And at a time where, like, I'm finding as I get older, there's like elements of joy that leave my life. And it's really only because of my own choices and my own perspectives that joy departs. And so I left going, yeah. If I could somehow spend the next 2 years being as aware as Charlie, but as earnest and hopeful as Donald, I would be in a really great place. And that moment of,
you might say you'd be adapting.
I'd be, well, exactly. And so that yeah. is a lot of what this movie is ultimately about, is that growth, is that adapting. You've got the orchid itself, which survives against all odds in a swamp. You've got John LaRoche, who anytime he loses interest in something, just changes his life to move to that next thing. You know,
I have a note here that says where, like, one of the first scenes where we're introduced to LaRoche is like, and then one day I just said, fuck fish.
Yeah, that's how much
I'm done with fish. It's been 12 years. I haven't set foot in that ocean since. And then what's her name is like, well, why not? He's like, just fuck fish.
Fuck fish. And so like, and that's really what ultimately hit me thematically about this movie, is like, it is about that growth and it is about that change. And you have Charlie, who is so resistant to change that he's stuck. And you have Donald, who is, you know, a blowhard, kind of clueless, but he's so willing to adapt to any situation. And that he ends up having a much more thorough and joyous creative life. Whereas Charlie, who's like, I got to make it true, I've got to make it real, he's stressing out. He ends up driving himself insane because he absolutely refuses to adapt. And then the ultimate success story is that his willingness to be adaptive to even the process of adaptation and taking The Orchid Thief and turning it into the film adaptation shows such a Herculean effort of willing to be adaptive, for him to say, yeah. This assignment is not possible, but a different assignment is possible, and I'm going to adapt to do that. And it was remarkable, and it kind of like put me on my ass watching this the other night. Just an unbelievable flick.
Yeah, there's like, I'm trying not to use this word too much because it is an accurate descriptor, but it is a cringeworthy word for me, but it is very meta.
Yeah.
It is the onion gets peeled down to its core and then some, for a lot of the movie. I wrote this down. I think I wrote it down wrong, but you probably have written down correctly. But the quote where it's like, adaptation is a great process. You figure out how to thrive in the world, which is basically what you were just talking about. And like when that line hit, I was like, okay, this is what we're working with here.
Mm-hmm.
This applies to literally every fucking frame of this movie that we've been watching for the past 2 hours. And it's just insane how he's able to write this in such a nuanced way where there's almost a lot of, again, like, what am I watching here? What's going on? It seems to be like piece over piece over piece. And then once this line is dropped, it like all the pieces fell into where they're supposed to be for me at that point.
Mm. I had a similar experience the second time I watched the movie Us, because Us to me is like, you know, it's about a lot of things, but it's mostly about the struggles of transitioning from different levels of class. And watching that movie a second time, every line in that movie ends up being somewhat about that shift from class. Like the very first line in Us is the guy at the carnival asking the little girl if she wants to take the lower shelf prize or if maybe she wants to roll the dice and go for a bigger shelf prize. And like every little thing is down to that theme. And I think adaptation holds true where really every moment is about struggling to adapt and struggling to fit into an ever-changing world, an ever-changing industry, and an ever-changing idea of what it is to be creative. And so for this movie to be so thorough with its theme, even though we know it is the product of a guy struggling to adapt an actual book, is just, it's just remarkable. I mean, it gets down to the point where every rule of screenwriting is broken. And then we have a character that's introduced to tell us the rules of screenwriting.
Just Brian so Cox, that baby.
Brian Cox, he was born 75 and he will stay 75 his whole life. I love that man. Dude,
not to derail you, but there was a point before that scene was, I had happened to like look down my phone and get a little distracted, I'll be honest with you. And I started like going through a little doom scroll situation. And then I heard the voice of Brian Cox.
Yep.
And I immediately turned my phone off, put it face down. I was like, what do you got for me?
I like to imagine that also happens on his McDonald's commercials where you're like on your phone and then you hear him do the ba-da-ba-ba-ba and you're like, I know that voice.
Is that really him?
He's the voice of McDonald's.
Oh my God. No way.
Yeah. And he's the voice of a couple of the McDonald's commercials. I'm really good at that. There was actually a sea change recently because for a while the voiceover for every commercial was either Chris Parnell or Kevin Spacey.
Wow.
And Kevin Spacey has now been phased out. But yeah.
Why?
I'm gonna let you Google that and you can go down a really an endlessly entertaining wormhole.
I saw a Honda commercial the other day. I was like, all right, John Cena, like calm down. We all know it's you.
Oh, yeah.
We can't see you, but we can hear you.
We know that voice. But the point I was making is that I love that this movie ultimately embraces all of the things that Charlie, as a professional and non-sellout, air quotes, screenwriter, knows not to do. You know, you're not supposed to use Deus Ex Machina. He uses Deus Ex Machina in the form of a crocodile, you know?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to use voiceover. This movie begins and ends in voiceover. It's like a Dexter episode.
He will literally be voiceover writing, I put that in air quotes, voiceover writing the scene that happened a scene and a half ago. And that's like my favorite part. He does it like a few times. I'm like, here we go again. All right, drive it home. This is great.
Yeah. And even so far as like, you know, everything, we can't figure out what to do with this plot. So he puts an action sequence in there, a car chase. Yeah. You know, I can't figure out what to do with this character. So he just invents another character to be the foil towards Charlie. He invents that brother, that imaginary brother who was also nominated for an Oscar for writing this movie. Yeah. And which is an amazing bit that the Oscars, you know, did that. But I wanted to point out, this is the movie where, because like voiceover is not bad, I don't think. It can be used as a cheat, but if you use it well, it works. Case in point, the early seasons of Dexter do a great job with it. The later seasons, not so much. But this movie, having a anti-voiceover character in it, did for voiceover what the movie Sideways did for Merlot. Because in Sideways, Paul Giamatti's character absolutely refuses to drink Merlot because the grape has no character and blah, 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 blah. Now, there are good Merlots and bad Merlots like there are for any type of wine. But because Sideways, a movie that is about classy wine guys, featured a character saying, I don't drink Merlot, sales of Merlot in the wake of that movie dropped because people just are dumb and were like, oh, I guess that means Merlot is bad. You know,
Paul Giamatti said it.
Paul Giamatti said, like, remember when you could always tell what booze was mentioned in a music video by what was selling that week at Chili's?
Yeah.
Same sort of thing. And it became an unspoken rule in the world of film writing, like, maybe lay off the voiceover. And that all sources back to this movie, which simultaneously says, like, yo, voiceover is cheap, but embraces voiceover and uses it brilliantly. And to me, that is a level of meta that is, like, it's hard to even comprehend the level that Charlie's, like, at the end of the day, it feels to me like Charlie Kaufman is still at home writing this movie, because yeah, it's constantly snowballing over its own themes and rules. And that's just, I mean, he's like a fucking Hercules when it comes to writing, but just brilliant.
I think also, like, that plays into the rejection, not the rejection, but, like, the being hard on yourself for the product you're outputting. Because it starts out with, the adaptation starts out with him on the set of Being John Malkovich, which was a critical hit. Mm. And it, you know, made him Hollywood's, you know, biggest get at the time.
Mm.
And having to follow that up, like having to follow up the big act with something else, like that is a kind of pressure that very few people ever go through. And it is crushing.
I think okay, so here's a great, I mean, it happens to musicians where they have one record that crushes, and then it's so popular that they have to crank out a second record, and their first record that they spent 10 years writing, now they have to follow it up with a record that they spend 1 year writing.
Yeah.
And but like a great example was Dane Cook's first album exploded, and that's the album that he wrote for his whole life.
Yeah.
And then his second album, he had to boom, bang it out real fast. And it's just doesn't quite get there, at least not for me. And for Charlie Kaufman to take something like Being John Malkovich and then be stuck with, like, you got 4 years, crank out another brilliant script. And he does what every artist seems to fail to do in creating a successful second album, which is, all right, I'm looking inward. This is going to be about me. As opposed to, I'm going to pump out more of the same, or I'm going to try and one-up it. It was just, no, I'm just going to turn the cameras back on me, because, you know, what do I know better than writing myself? And it's just, what a brilliant move.
Yeah, it was great.
We all know that so much great work can come out of anxiety.
It also does a really good job at showing rejection, like the day-to-day rejection of somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Is, you know, what... Even though while he's doing this really huge project, career-defining project, he's also out there still looking for love. And it's the foil of Donald is great, because he seems to be finding it by doing almost nothing that Charlie is doing. And he still seems to find Maggie Gyllenhaal and he sells a script for like close to $1 million or somewhere in that range. And, you know, the animosity and the jealousy that Charlie ends up forming towards his brother's success, because he knows, like, Charlie's already been there. He's already been to the big leagues, and Donald is going to a seminar to learn how to screenwrite.
Yeah.
And so that's an insult to Charlie. And so it's a lot of, like, why not me? Why not me? Why not me? When he knows, and he knows, because you said earlier, he's very aware, he knows that's the wrong fucking question.
Yeah.
But he also knows for this script, it's the right question. Why not me?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I think what it comes down to, the answer to why not me, is that Donald puts himself out there.
Yeah.
He is actually vulnerable in a way where he's like, I'm going to write this script. I'm going to write the three, and I'm just going to do my best. I'm going to follow the rules and see what I can come up with. You know, he gets Maggie Gyllenhaal because he's willing to go talk to her. Whereas Charlie, he's got this woman, I believe the actress's name is Kara Seymour, who is gorgeous, kind, is fascinated by him and loves him. And he cannot bring himself to make a move because he's so afraid of that rejection, even though it's clear as day, he's not going to get rejected. And he just refuses to put himself out there. Whereas Donald's just like, I'm going to go hit on the makeup girl because fuck it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that Charlie envies that so much, and it causes him to be not even really jealous, but like there's an enmity to it where he just... He's not necessarily mad at Donald for following the rules or taking a screenwriting class. He's mad because he knows he can't bring himself to be that vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't possibly deal with the rejection that Donald is just profoundly unafraid of.
Yeah.
It comes down to that great, great scene where they're hiding behind the rock at the end.
And it's a log. Did you even watch the movie?
Or a log, whatever it is. And well, here's the thing. I was like teary-eyed, so I was getting blurry vision. Oh. Because right, he tells that logged story.
Rocks, they look the same in the dark.
You know, it's tears. We're in the Everglades. It's a log, it's a rock, it's an alligator. What do you want? And but he tells this story about, he's like, I watched you, you know, I always envied the way that you were able to approach this one girl in high school. And he's like, and I saw you walk away and you were smiling. He's like, but you didn't see it. But her and her friends immediately made fun of you for doing that. And Donald reveals his big secret, which just broke my heart, but inspired me. And he said, oh, I saw it, but my happiness is my own. And I loved her. I'm not going to let her take that away from me. And Charlie says, but she didn't love you. And he goes, well, that was her problem.
Yeah.
And I...
What a great line.
It's such a great line. And what a beautiful outlook towards life, where it was just like, it felt good that she at least respected him enough not to mock him to his face. And it made him feel happy. He doesn't care if she's mocking him behind his back, because fuck her. He's got his happiness and whatever. And he says my favorite line of the whole movie, which is, you are what you love, not what loves you. And we look at Donald. He loves writing his script. He loves going out with Maggie Gyllenhaal. He loves putting himself out there and making crass jokes and doing his thing. He's not concerned if any of that is reciprocated. He's not concerned if his script fails, because he loves writing it and he wants the world to read it. Whereas Charlie's so concerned with exposing himself to the girl that he's sort of dating. He's so concerned that his script will not be received the right way. He's so concerned that, now I can't think of Meryl Streep's character's name. He's so concerned that she's not going to like the guy who's adapting her book that he refuses to even meet her. And it ends up being his biggest barrier to success, is that he's so concerned with how he's received. Whereas Donald ends up succeeding because he's just unafraid to fail, unafraid to look stupid, and unconcerned with feeling anyone else's emotions but his own. And, you know, there was a time where I feel like I used to be more like that in my life. And as I've gotten older and shame kicked in, that's gone away. And
yeah,
there's a middle ground, though. And I think that middle ground is represented by Donald. And I just find it to be so aspirational and inspirational. I want to be more of a Donald. I really do. I'm going to do it.
All right.
I hope that everyone approves also of my new lease on life. Because if they don't, I don't know what I'll do.
I'll start calling you Don Scully if you want me to.
There's a lot of Dons in this world that I'm not interested in being related to. So I would love to just move away from that. It's more of an aesthetic thing, but you know.
Also the line, you are what you love, not what loves you. That is also the prominent line in Fall Out Boy's Save Rock and Roll featuring Elton John.
Really?
And so when he said that line, I started singing in my head and it kind of ruined the moment for me.
That's amazing, though, because you know, though, they are pop culture savvy. I mean, their band name is a Simpsons reference.
They definitely ripped it right from the pages.
They took it right from there. And that's one of the things I like about Fall Out Boy, is that, like, you know, they are playing to a crowd of guys like us who are influenced by pop culture and who do get moved by pop culture and who do love Fall Out Boy and Radioactive Man up and at them. And, you know, so I'm into that.
I like, speaking of Donald, there was one line that I wrote down that was really funny to me, because when Charlie's having the epiphany, he's like, I'm going to write myself into the script. And he's like telling Donald the whole idea, blah, blah, blah. And then Donald's like, hey, am I in the script? And then Charlie just walks out of the room.
That's brilliant.
And then when he gives Donald the script to read and he like finishes it up, the first thing Donald said was, and I'm paraphrasing, he's like, well, you're kind of mean to me.
Yeah. No, but then he goes, he's like, you were kind of mean about me. And he was like, well, no, I didn't mean it like that. And he goes, I don't mind. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm into it. He has a, where's that line? Oh, fuck. I don't think I wrote it down. But Donald has a line to that regard where he's like, fuck, I'm gonna have to think of it over the break because I lost my train of thought. But what does he say to him? I'm gonna write
he
you
says,
into the
hey,
script.
This is the first movie where we see Meryl Streep's boobs.
Oh yeah. See some boobies.
I'm sure those are not her real boobs.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. She is an artiste. She might not be, you know, she might not be you know, above that. But yeah, I really am moved by the way that Donald exists in the world.
Me too.
And oh, I remember the line when Donald goes, I'm gonna go meet up with the author and pretend to be you. And he's like, because he's more confident. And then Charlie says something like, you know,
don't laugh the way that you do.
Yeah, and he's like, don't laugh the way that you do. And he goes, oh, I'm not gonna laugh. I have to make her think I'm you.
Yeah. And then they cut to him and is in the office. He's laughing hysterically. Yeah.
But I just love that he's immediately like, no, you don't laugh and I gotta be you. And it was like heartbreaking, but also, you know, again, very moving to the idea that Donald's keyed in. He's actually more aware than even he would give himself credit for.
Exactly.
Well, let's take a quick break for an ad, and when we come back, we'll talk a little more about the themes and a little bit about the filmmaking, and then we're going to count down some of our favorite movies where one actor plays two people or twins.
Adaptation?
An ad, bat, yeah.
All right. Goodbye.
Sure. Hey everybody, it's me, Dan. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know if the ads on the podcast are actually working because I don't think we have enough listeners to be able to activate ads. Now, this is partially my fault because of the time that I took off from doing Movie, but that doesn't mean I can't record an ad for the podcast itself, which is what you are listening to right now. So, make sure you follow I Like to Movie at MovieMovieCast on all of the things. Please subscribe. Please tell your friends. It would be very helpful if you could subscribe specifically on Spotify. That really beefs up the numbers. If you heard a little bell jingling, that's my cat's collar because she came running over because she can't let me record a fucking commercial in peace. Hi, Doris. Hi, Stinky. But please do all of that and check out our other show, Hot Property, at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll get you back to the show. We are part of the Hot Property Podcast Network. Peace. So I think we should talk a little bit about Spike Jonze's filmmaking.
All right, I'll let you lead since I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Oh, you know what you're talking about. Didn't you go to film school?
No.
Spike Jonze came out of music video directing, as I mentioned earlier. And one of the cool things about directing a music video is that, you know, so think about the people who came out of it. You got your Aronofskys, you've got David Fincher, you know, people like that. And one of the cool things about coming out of directing music videos is that music videos have to use the rule of show, don't tell. Because you can't really have a script because the audio is entirely populated by the song of whatever you're doing. So to tell the story, you have to be almost entirely visual. And I think that Spike Jonze is really, really good at telling a full story with his visuals. Now, granted, you know, Charlie Kaufman, no matter who shoots the script, it's going to be good because the script is so good. But I think that it's such a beautiful marriage between filmmaker and writer. Same with, you know, they're the same duo behind Being John Malkovich, is you need that show, don't tell visual aesthetic. And with Spike Jonze, you get fun things like a choppy, anxiety-ridden montage that tells the entire history of adaptation through the eyes of Charles Darwin. You have flashbacks to Doug Jones as an ancient explorer trying to find this rare orchid and getting killed in the process. And I didn't realize that was Doug Jonze until after I watched the movie this time around. And I think that then also you get the insane visual trickery required to have two Nicolas Cages on screen interacting with one another and handing each other objects and third characters talking to both Charlie and him at the same time with effects that are mostly done in camera. And you know, and that, I think that that's, what's his name? Kaufman has also teamed up with Michelle Gondry a couple times, who's also a very big music video director. He did a lot of White Stripes stuff. He also is a let's do as much in camera as possible as opposed to post-production. And so I think that in a lot of ways that we're seeing Charlie Kaufman flex his chops as a writer, we are also seeing Spike Jonze flex his chops as a filmmaker. Somehow, against all odds, we have these two profound artists, just these insanely talented guys, really, really flexing and being showy, but never does it feel excessive, despite the fact that they're going bigger than any writer director really tends to go with such a project. And it could be wildly unwieldy, and yet it goes down easy and is one of the more balanced narratives that I've seen, despite, as you said, you know, so much going on at once.
Yeah, and I was actually trying to like find the cracks in the seam of like where, like, how are they filming him talking to himself or talking to somebody else, and like I couldn't do it because it was just so well done.
It's so clean. And you know, like one of my favorite instances where you can see a seam is, you know, the scenes in Half Baked where Dave Chappelle's character is also talking to the rapper that's played by Dave Chappelle. And
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
It's really funny. But there's a scene where the rapper is talking to Dave Chappelle's character, and Chappelle's character has his back to the camera, and it's so clearly not him because the double that they're using is just so much blacker. He's like really dark in his skin tone. But you know, it works, but like that's just like a cheapy little comedy. And you know, so they didn't go all out to make sure that it was seamless, and it still works. But the fact that they're able to hide doubles so much better, they're able to do a split screen that has dynamic backgrounds to it, despite, you know, having to have a dividing line in the middle. You know, it's not like when you watch the old Haley Mills Parent Trap, where you can actually see the line down the middle of a lot of, you know, of a lot of frames. That's gone. And they actually, on South Park once, they did like a Bizarro episode where the Bizarro Cartman showed up, and it was just Cartman with a goatee. But anytime both Cartmans are on screen, they animated like a shitty line between them so that it was as if they had to shoot Cartman double. It was real.
That's genius.
You know, but this movie definitely foregoes that. And I think that the, you know, the filmmaking is just a home run. And then add to that, Carter Burwell did the music for it. And Carter Burwell's like every Coen's movie. And I think that that just, it really is such a unique mixture of talents operating at the top of their game. I would say this is a top five Nick Cage performance for me.
I
go up and down with how much I enjoy Meryl Streep. This is probably my favorite Meryl Streep performance. And Chris Cooper is just always good, but you know, you shook your head. Do you have a preferred Meryl Streep performance?
No, that was me going, yeah, you're right. I agree with that statement. Yeah.
And hey, no love lost. I love Meryl Streep, but
it's definitely not Mamma Mia.
It's not Mamma Mia or Mamma Mia. Here we go again. Or which is Mama how Mia I like three. To say it, Mamma Thria. Eh?
Man, why did they name it that?
Yeah, is there a three? I think there's only two.
There's a three coming out.
Really? I mean, ABBA does have a lot of songs. But
I think it's coming out.
I would absolutely believe it. I've never seen them, and to tell you the truth, I would absolutely watch them. ABBA is in like my top 10 bands, I would say.
Mamma Mia 3 in the works, and show's creator thinks Meryl Streep could star if the script is right.
Do they have a title yet? Because Mamma Mia is Mamma Mia.
No, Mamma Mia 3.
Dancing Queen. Like, they're just going to really sell out with the title.
Yeah.
Also, because we keep fucking up her name, Susan Orlean is the writer of The Orchid
Susan
Thief.
Orlean.
Yeah, Susan Orlean.
And if she had a kid, it would be a New Orlean.
Hey! If You know what? I can't do it. I was trying to set up Lean on Me and have Susan Orlean buying you a drink and saying it's on me, and it didn't come together in time.
Well, that scene where she's banging John LaRoche, he could say, now I've got Orlean on me.
Yeah. Ah, when you're not strong. So this came out at a time where, so there's a
9/11 had just happened.
9/11 had just happened, and we just not figured that it really, out. Doesn't really affect this movie. well, there is that one scene with the terror. No,
there's that one scene where Ron Livingston says, I fucked her in the ass.
That is the funniest fucking takedown of the objectiveness, not objectiveness, like objectification that is inherent to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Is that he's sitting there listening about the script and he's like, you see that? I'd fuck her in the ass. I did fuck her in the ass. Like, that is the most crass, awful, misogynistic thing. And he cannot see a woman pass his office without commenting on whether or not he did, would, or wouldn't fuck her in the ass. It's like, it's insane.
With one sentence, you sum up the classic Hollywood sleazeball.
Yeah. And I think that also speaks to, like, the heightened nature of the world that this takes place in. Is that, like,
yeah,
that's probably not exactly how that executive would say it, but it's not far off from the real world. It's close, but it's kind of tweaked to be a little funny so that it's not just absolutely horrifying. And this is
around the same time where, like, Donald Trump had that that mic'd up moment in the bus, on the extra bus, where he's talking about grabbing him by the pussy.
Is that when this occurred?
This is around the same time, yeah.
Around when that occurred? Not when it was leaked. It was leaked in like...
It was leaked during the election, but it happened around it happened in the early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I lost my train of thought. Fuck! I'd fuck her in the ass. All the realistic stuff. Oh, I don't know. Who cares? But I think that fuck, it's gone. I lost my thought. It's totally gone.
That's right.
Yeah. But Tilda Swinton shows up in this as well, and she is often she often plays twins. She played twins in what's that Coen Brothers movie? Hail Caesar. And then she also plays
that one.
Oh, it's great. And she also plays twins, I believe, in Moonrise Kingdom. And I forgot that Tilda Swinton was even in this movie. But,
well, every time I see Tilda Swinton now, I think about Conan O'Brien.
Yeah. Because they're going to play each other in the biopics. No, I wanted
to because say... he one time he was doing his self-deprecating bit, and he's like, yeah, women are often either disgusted by me, or they think, oh, I can get Tilda Swinton's autograph now.
She might even be taller than him. But
I don't know, man. Conan's like 6'5".
Yeah, he's a big dude with an even bigger heart, because he took Fen-Phen. Now, this came out at a time where we had just figured out how to do that shot where someone's driving and then their car gets hit and everybody in the car, and it's just funny that in Hollywood we will learn a trick like that and then they use it to death.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, for a while...
The opposite is that they didn't use voiceover, but they used that car shot a lot.
They used that car shot. And so, and like, there was an era in Hollywood where you couldn't see someone driving in a car like this without expecting them to get T-boned because it was used so often. Before that, we were in the era of people getting cut in pieces and not realizing it until they fall to pieces. That was an effect that we figured out.
Before that, the movies were silent.
And before then we started putting sound in everything. Right now we're in an era of it's a riff on the car being hit, and it's a car rolling, and we see it from the point of view of the car, and everyone in slow motion moves, which I don't
the wave.
I don't know how the fuck they do that. That's a how do you do that. I have no fucking clue how they make that shot. But yeah, this was one of the first car gets T-boned movies, and then that was in every fucking movie forever. And then it faded out when we figured out new technology. I could go for a T-bone. Man, I haven't had a fucking piece of beef in a long time. Craving it. Maybe I'll do that.
Well, when they showed Chris Cooper's bare ass, I was craving some beef.
Yeah, lots of beef there. He's really fantastic in this. I think that he's a guy who never really looks the same in two movies, and he really looks like a real person in this.
In that scene when like Charlie is sneaking around the house and he sees him and he's like he's about to fucking like beat the shit out of him until Susan's like, oh no, this is the screenwriter. And he immediately changes. He's like, oh man, hey, how you doing? Hey, who's gonna play me in the movie?
Hey, let me get your number.
Not questioning at all why or how he is here. It's like, who's gonna play me in the movie?
You know why? Because he's good at adapting.
Yeah.
He's very good at adapting. He's just like, there's a guy in my house, but now that I know the guy, let's be friends.
And then the movie's pretty much all downhill from there emotionally because everyone starts dying. And that scene, oh my God, Nick Cage as Donald has one of the most visceral, like last gasps
in a
death scene I've ever seen in my life.
It's heartbreaking, but I love, and it's like one of the most uncomfortable laughs I've ever had when Donald's looking at him and he's like, Hey, you know, no, you gotta breathe. You gotta stay with me. Imagine me and you. It's true. I think about you day and night. But then he starts singing the song that Donald wants to put into his screenplay.
Shunned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which another thing that was really brilliant about this movie is that it ends on a needle drop of a song, and then it does not continue that needle drop to the credits. It cuts it off before the credits hit, which never happens. And so it's a little bit Donald of, no, let's get a pop song in there, and a little bit Charlie that's like, all right, but let's be a real movie for a second. Can we just get some score over there? There's so many levels of this script being self-aware and existing in conversation with itself. Just fucking brilliant. I also love I love when they're high on whatever the orchid powder is and they're trying orchid dust and they're trying to make a dial tone noise. But I think the peak use of that drug is early on when Susan goes to visit what's his name's farm and the dude is like, wow, you have really soft hair and blah, blah, blah. And it plays as if this is a guy who lives on a reservation, who doesn't really leave the reservation much, seeing a blonde white woman and is just like, oh, wow, this is so cool. And then later we find out, he's just fucking stoned. Just completely stoned.
I didn't remember any of the drug stuff about the movie until that scene. And I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This guy's high as hell.
Yeah. But what I love is that drug turns you into a Donald. That drug makes you somebody who goes, wow, I'm just interested in experiencing this. And it doesn't matter whether it's the right thing, the wrong thing. Like, you have soft hair. That's amazing. Yeah. Let's celebrate it. You know, it's the three. When Charlie's trying to explain that it is not logical that the man and the woman and the cop chasing them can actually be the same person. And literally no one who reads the script cares at all about that. It's brilliant. And I don't know if it's specifically talking about Fight Club, but that was one of the things that people initially resisted about Fight Club was that device doesn't make sense because a lot of stuff we see requires them to be two people. And then with time, you realize, well, no, what we're seeing is the narrator's interpretation, which is skewed and allows for everything. And in that world, the three works. And Charlie cannot see that way. It has to be real. It has to be what is actually happening, else it doesn't make sense. Meanwhile, adaptation itself requires an imaginary brother to even work at all. It has to have two characters that are essentially one guy. And again, a moment of the script existing in conversation with itself that is just goddamn brilliant. I could go on forever. It's the fucking best. But this time around, watching this at the age of Charlie Kaufman and, you know, Nick Cage at the time is just kind of a head trip because time is a bitch, man. So I was, this came out 2002, so I was 18. So 20 years ago, this came out. And now I'm the same age as Nick Cage was.
I was 15 then.
insane, truly insane. Because I remember looking at you know, the movies Charlie Kaufman and thinking, wow, he's an old man. And at 18, 38, it's like, yeah, you're almost 40. And now I'm like, I'll be 39 in like a couple months. And 40 does not seem old because I still feel like a child.
Yeah.
And I still act like a child.
I just got a lightsaber tattoo.
Yeah, I literally, as I said that, was letting out a silent fart, and I'm basking in it right now.
Nice.
Because that is who we are. Do you have any final thoughts to say about adaptation before we get onto the lists?
No, I think I've pretty much got it all out. Great movie.
Fantastic movie. Perfect movie, I'd say.
It's one of those things I'll keep thinking about for a long time, you know?
I think this is one that I'm, now that I've watched it again, I'm going to rewatch more often, just now that it's,
yeah,
it is where it is. But I wanted to point out something that I never noticed before, because when this came out, it was before we knew to stay
until the end. 9/11 had just happened.
9/11 had just happened. And 9/11 is about the time where we started to understand there might be something after the credits. And because 9/11 let us know. And, but
yeah.
I never knew to stay to the end of the credits of this movie. Do you know what happens at the end of the credits?
No, because my subscription or my rental on Amazon had cut off in the middle of the credits.
At the end of the credits, there's not a scene or anything, but the very end of the credits dedicates the film to the memory of Donald. But before that, they put on the screen a quote from The Three. And I would like to read this quote from The Three, yes. Donald's script.
Yeah.
"We're all one thing, Lieutenant. That's what I've come to realize. Like cells in a body. Except we can't see the body, the way fish can't see the ocean. And so we envy each other, hurt each other, hate each other. How silly is that? A heart cell hating a lung cell." And that's quoted to Cassie from The Three. And it's such a silly line that sounds like something from a shitty thriller like that, but it also thematically speaks to the idea of adaptation, where it's like, no, him and his brother are one and the same, and we kind of all are one and the same. Like, it's not normal or functional for me to hate someone who is just me from a different circumstance. It's not, and it ends up being this like beautifully deep quote, but it's also a silly joke because you go, that is the exact line that Cassie would say in The Three. And the fact that we're all one thing, Lieutenant. Like, she's talking to the lieutenant.
Yeah.
Who is also her. It's so good.
Do you think that the real Charlie Kaufman wrote an entire script?
Do I think he did? I don't know. Do I think he certainly would have? Yeah, sure. I think he's definitely the type. I mean, the dude is nothing if not prolific.
His
shit is just, he's constantly writing. I'm sitting on his novel. It's a giant novel that I haven't started yet. That might be next, though. Called Ant Kind. But so it is. But yeah, adaptation, man. Fucking killer.
I misread the assignment.
Okay, what was your read on it?
Because we can make it work. Exclusively twins, because I just did actors who played. Okay.
Yeah, it can be multiple roles in one movie. Yeah.
Got it.
Because I have a mixed list. Yeah.
I would like to start us off with.
Okay, so wait. So for the listeners, what this is we are listing, just like Nick Cage in adaptation, some of our favorite instances of actors and actresses playing multiple characters in a movie, sometimes twins, sometimes not, but multiple characters to one actor.
I don't know if this is going to count, but
it counts because you put it there.
I'm going to go with Mrs. Doubtfire.
Okay. I mean, that's not it. It's not necessarily
the same. It's really the same character, but he's playing two characters.
Yeah.
He's playing two roles within the story of the movie.
It's not what I imagined with the assignment, but I think it's defensible because he does have to give two performances.
Yeah.
I'm into that.
But I also have, like an auxiliary number five if I need to.
Yeah. Pop
which
it
is
out.
The Austin Powers series.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic. When I walked out of Goldmember the first time, because I don't know, I think the girl I was with was like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
But then I went back and watched, I was like, this is fucking genius.
Oh, yeah, they're so funny. I would love to rewatch those. I heard he's cooking up an Austin Powers 4, and a piece of me is like, but another piece of me is like, fuck it, let's go.
Austin Powers 1 was on at the bar like a couple months ago, maybe even last year. And we were, as a group, watching it. And we're like, I don't know how this movie would survive today. This is rough.
It's great, though. It's classic.
It is good, yeah.
I remember when I rented that as a kid, and the scene where he pees forever. I remember, like being concerned that I was going to suffocate because I was laughing so hard at him peeing when he got out of warm liquid goo phase. He's pissing for the longest time, and his legs twitching, and then he stops, and then he farts and starts peeing more. It's like, and the joke doesn't even make sense, because if he was frozen, he's not consuming any liquids. He shouldn't have to pee at all, but who cares? It doesn't matter. I think that's a good answer. All right, so my number five is Jack Nicholson in Mars Attacks, because he plays the president. And he also plays the cowboy casino owner, who's like a woo-wee! Yeah. And he does it so well. Now, granted, when I saw this movie, I was too young to really have that much of a concept of what Jack Nicholson was. He was like the Joker and Wolf and things like that. But now I know he's Jack Nicholson. And he plays Jack Nicholson, the president. He's a shyster that makes sure that, you know, I think he says something like, the aliens have blown up one of the three branches of government, but last I checked, two out of three ain't bad. Like, he's kind of a president. Yeah. But then he's also the casino owner who dresses as a cowboy and is like shooting guns into the sky as he wantonly is killed by aliens. And it's just a wild performance that, like, we should be so lucky that Jack Nicholson, the legend, the greatest to ever do it, was willing to do two supremely goofy characters for fucking Mars Attacks, of all things. Like, hell yeah.
The movie hell where Jack Black plays a Marine.
Yeah, and gets fucking got real hard.
Yeah.
He gets zapped before he was anybody.
I think he's in that movie before for like 30 seconds.
Yeah, he's got the buzz hair and everything. He's but like, No Love Lost, I think that movie is just tremendous.
That's my only good Tim Burton movie.
You don't like Batman or Batman Returns?
No.
Or Ed Wood? Or Big Fish?
I'll go Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow? He's got a lot of good stuff. Pee-wee's Big Adventure? That's the funniest movie that's ever been made.
We've talked about this before.
We're going to talk about it again before our lives
are through. I'm on record as saying I don't like Tim Burton.
Yeah, but do you like Pee-wee?
No.
It's written by Phil Hartman.
I love Phil Hartman. He was great in House Guest.
This is violence. This is a form of violence.
House Guest with Sinbad?
I do. I also remember Jingle All the Way, where he was the neighbor. Phil Hartman, the neighbor. You got to put some chains on those wheels. I can't do a Phil Hartman. I can only do...
You sound like Ned Flanders, which is essentially what Phil Hartman is anyway.
No, what's the character's name that he plays? I'm blah blah blah. You might remember Troy McClure. You might remember me Man, what a loss! What a loss! Phil Hartman
If you put a little bit of smooth on Troy McClure, well, then you got Billy Dee Williams.
That's true. That's true. Phil Hartman is the creator and performer of the best, in my estimation, the best SNL sketch and best SNL character ever. Do you know who it is?
No.
Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer. Do you remember that? Where he was lawyer.
But I'm in.
He's a lawyer and he's got long hair and he's got like a giant forehead on and he's a caveman. But he talks like this. But his defense is always like, he'll just be like, ladies and gentlemen of the court, listen, I'm a caveman. There's a lot of things I don't know. Fire scares me. I think that lightning is some sort of magic coming from the sky. I get confused with tools that are more advanced than rocks. But if I know one thing, I know this. that man over there, he's no criminal. And like his defense is always, I'm a caveman. There's a lot of things I don't understand, but I'll tell you this, my client is innocent. And it's Phil Hartman's voice. And like the makeup of the unfrozen caveman is garish and he looks ridiculous, but he's got a great suit. Yeah. It's my favorite SNL sketch because it's a one note sketch. All it is he just explains what he doesn't understand because he's a caveman and then wins the case by being like, but I'll tell you this, I've got a good heart and so does my client. And like, it's insane. It's truly insane. And the only reason it works is because Phil Hartman's performance, even though it's identical every time, it's like MacGruber, where it just never gets old that everything blows up because they won't hand him the weird thing that he needs, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer, Maron. Good stuff. What's your number four?
Coming to America.
Oh, right on. Great flick.
Yeah. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember thinking, that's Eddie Murphy. And that's Eddie Murphy. And that's Eddie Murphy. And like these really tiny bit roles. And I want to rewatch it, and then I want to watch the second one soon. But I don't have much more to say about it because it's been so long. But I just remember that overall feeling of, wait a minute, that's also Eddie Murphy.
I mean, it's a pretty impressive set of performances. He's a regular Mike Portnoy. Or Jeff Portnoy.
So kind of like, I was going to say more like Mel Brooks, where like Mel Brooks will be just constantly playing bit roles in his own movies. Yeah.
He's President Scroob and he's Yogurt in Spaceballs.
Yeah.
President Scroob.
Yeah.
Jeff Portnoy was a reference to Jack Black in Tropic Thunder.
Wow.
Jeff Portnoy and Jeff Portnoy.
Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports.
Yeah, and Mike Portnoy, the drummer that guy sucks. The drummer for Dream Theater. My number four is my wife, Kate Blanchett, in Coffee and Cigarettes. Scene where she plays Kate Blanchett, and then Kate Blanchett's either sister or cousin, I forget, and they're having their coffee and cigarettes together. And one of them is a little bit more buttoned up, and the other one is a little more like rock and roll. And so it's just Kate Blanchett doing what she does best, which is going to 11 when 10 will do just fine. But she does that better than anybody, and it's why we love her. And so it's just, you know, Coffee and Cigarettes is a bunch of short films from Jarmusch. Yeah. Who I actually almost bumped into while at the Overlook Film Festival. He was there presenting a movie. And he was not as tall as I thought, as I expected. But it's just a great sequence in the middle of a great movie.
He could not overlook you.
He could not overlook me. I could overlook him. Well, his hair was pretty big. But so Cate Blanchett and Coffee and Cigarettes. Not much to say, but she should leave her husband and marry me.
I'm sure Jenna would love that. My number three is...
Jenna's into it. Jenna can stay. We'll make it a party. Yes, nice.
Split, another movie that I think earns more of a place on this list than Miss Doubtfire because he is actually playing all those roles.
Yeah.
Even though they are all contained inside of one body. That movie is awesome for many reasons. I wish they stuck the landing in Glass, but Split, I remember being very special because it was like, oh man, Shyamalan's back. And not only is he back, but he brought the secret sequel with him.
Yeah. And that
secret
was like
sequel with him.
I will never forget the moment when that was revealed in the theater. And it was just like, fuck, like what a
you texted me right after. You're like, you need to go see Split now.
Don't let anyone spoil that shit. Yeah that's like so well done. But yeah, McAvoy is unbelievable in that movie.
I remember the girl I was dating at the time, we watched Split first. And then, because I was like, Dan told me I gotta watch this movie like right now. Do you want to watch it with me? She's like, yeah. And so then we got to the secret sequel post-credit or mid-credit scene. And I was like, what the fuck? And she was like, she's like, what? I was like, have you never seen Unbreakable? And she's like, no. I'm like, sit down. So she watched it reverse order and she still was like, she went back and she's like, holy shit, that's awesome.
That's probably a really fun way to do it too, where you go, oh, that's a cool little thriller. And then you go, oh, there's a mythology. I liked Glass, but I agree that it didn't quite stick the landing. But there's nothing more Philadelphia than Bruce Willis drowning in a puddle. I think that that's definitely yeah. I liked Glass, but I agree that it doesn't quite deliver on the promise. But what are you gonna do? All right, my number three is Southland Tales, a movie that I adore. You would hate it, but Sean William Scott plays twin brothers in it, and Sean William Scott. Movie. Well, I think it's something that you would enjoy watching. We might. Could sit down and watch it sometime. I have a friend, hi Jeff, who wants to be on the show to talk about it, so maybe we can set that up.
I've seen the Justin Timberlake music video part of it.
Okay, yeah, it's a lot of weird like that, but it's really a lot of fun, and it's, even if you don't like it or get it, I think it's entertaining. But Sean William Scott is incredible in it, and he plays two very different roles, and they eventually meet, and he has to do a lot of performing opposite himself, and it's pretty thematically strong when they finally meet and finally touch. It's also a crazy head trip moment, but I think Sean William Scott is so underrated, and Goon's incredible. And to have him do a big role twice in two different ways in one movie is just like, again, like that Nicholson thing. We should all be so lucky. And we are. Southland Tales, Sean William Scott. And another one where two of them on screen together is seamless. So that's my number three.
My number two, we can blow right by because we've already devoted our inaugural co-host episode to it. It is, in fact, The Prestige.
Prestige. So good.
Yeah.
And you've got two of them in there. You've got Christian Bale playing two characters as well as Hugh Jackman playing two characters.
Hugh Jackman. Yeah. He does some Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
And if you want to hear more about that, go back and listen to our first episode as co-hosts together, which was released in whatever it was released.
Whatever it was. Fantastic times.
Just scroll down. It wasn't that long ago. Just scroll.
Yeah, just scroll a little bit. You've probably already heard it if you're here. My number two is, it's not necessarily one of the biggest performances, but it's the best use of one actor playing two characters in service of a joke that I've ever seen.
Norbit.
No, not Norbit. Beerfest.
Oh, Beerfest rules.
Because in Beerfest,
who played two characters?
Kevin Heffernan plays Landfill, and then his character dies, and then Landfill's brother shows up to take his place, and he requests that everybody else just call him Landfill to make the transition easier. So essentially, their
That's
lineup
such a broken lizard
doesn't
thing to
change
do
at all. It's so funny. It's such a good gag. And he doesn't even really have to play two roles because that guy's just essentially Landfill too. But I had to shout it out because that's one of those things where that's such a bold choice of script. And it's all in service of something that's just silly. And, they actually kill off one of their core members and then immediately bring him back and do it in a way that they write their way around it as a goof. And it's just, they're like, wow, you're Landfill's brother. It's almost as if Landfill never left. And he's like, you know what? I feel so close to you guys that maybe you should just call me Landfill. And
it's so stupid.
Closer. And then it's never mentioned ever again.
It's so stupid.
It's so good. So I wanted to shout that out as my number two.
My number one, and I'm assuming since you haven't said it yet, this might be your number one as well, but it's got to be Back to the Future series.
All of
it. As a series unit, part two.
I did not put this in there because I was sure that you would put it in there. But this is
well, you got me.
This is the answer.
Yeah.
This is the answer.
Two and three, especially three, if you want to talk about just multiple roles of Michael J. Fox playing this is entire family lineage.
Oh yeah.
Or in Back to the Future 2 when he plays himself in slightly in the future. And Jennifer Grey, is that who is, or she was, who was the one that was replaced?
It's what's her name from The Boys and Hollow Man and Adventures in Babysitting? Elizabeth Shue.
Elizabeth Shue, yeah. She played herself a few times in that one as well. And then you have, of course, the king of playing himself through any era is the guy who played Biff.
Yeah.
Who was just phenomenal the entire series.
I want to get his name right. It's Tom something.
Tom Selleck.
No. Although, could you imagine the mileage they could get out of that mustache? Tom Wilson. Yeah, because in Back Tom to the Wilson. Future 2, he plays Biff, Griff, Old Biff, Alternate Reality Biff, and Benjamin Buford Tannen.
And 1950s.
And 1950s Biff, yeah. Now, yeah. I like in a, because Michael J. Fox in 2 plays himself, his older self, his punk kid, his daughter, and is there another one?
Yeah.
He hits them all, but that whole series is just filled with
and Flea plays his boss.
Yeah. Needles. What's the matter, McFly?
What's number one?
Number one is a movie I knocked off my shame list last week, Dead Ringers, with Jeremy Irons playing two twin brothers who are surgeons. And the one of them's real cocky and one of them's real timid. And the cocky one will go out and get women. And then the timid one will have sex with them. But they're also both, what's the word for vagina doctors that escapes me?
Gynecologists.
It's a David Cronenberg movie, so it's psychosexual. It's a little wild. But this is before the technology of, like, The Social Network, where you have two Army Hammers in the screen. This is all done with trick photography and extras, and it is seamless, and it's helped into its seamlessness by Jeremy Irons being just goddamn incredible as both brothers. Dead Ringers. And right now, Dead Ringers is being remade as a miniseries starring Rachel Weisz as sisters. So it's like a riff on that. And so I want to watch that. So I watched Dead Ringers. Highly recommend. But Jeremy Irons, we talked about him last week. Fucking God amongst men. But that's our time. Thank you, everybody. We support the WGA. So shout out to them. And adaptation, everybody. My name is Dan Scully. You can check out the show once again at Movie Movie Cast on all the things. You can check out everything I do at scullyvision.com. Steven. Anything to plug?
Nope.
Awesome. And that's been I Like to Movie Movie.
You almost said that property.
I did.
Bye.
Bye.